Good morning. I'd like to begin by praying. Let's pray. Father God, we ask that your Spirit would be present during this session and indeed during this whole day. Father, refresh our minds with your Spirit, warm our hearts, and cause us, Father, to draw closer to that perfect purpose and that perfect truth which is summed up in Christ. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Economics and the shaping of society. I want to start with an apology. In the section of the notebook, you only have my headings, a dozen or so headings, and bibliography. You really should have more than that. I like the excellent job that Jim did, but there's at least space there for you to jot a few notes down if you so wish. There is one additional handout, which Al is giving out now, but which I will not refer to until the end. So do not assume that this handout connects with what I'm about to say. It comes at the end. My thoughts this morning are built on the assumption that the history of how people in the West have thought about money and value and trade and business is instructive to us, is relevant. Much of what we take for granted was once a battleground, especially in business and commerce. Jim referred this earlier to the conflict of science and religion. Much of the way commerce functions today is a recent development. The word consumer has a very short history. So does the idea of progress. By looking back, however briefly, we want to be able to gain some perspective as business people. Economics, as you know, was once called the dismal science. It may be dismal, it's certainly dry, but I want to make it a little more interesting this morning because I believe that traders, merchants, entrepreneurs have often been the driving element in human social life, in culture after culture, as we trace it through the centuries. Indeed, economic activity, I suggest to you, is a forceful expression of the sevenfold mandate that we believers have in Genesis 1 and 2. There are seven Hebrew verbs, starting with be fruitful and multiply, and economics is the expression of God's instructions to us in the garden. Economic pressures have shaped society, and social needs, in turn, have conditioned the focus of economics. So there's a reciprocal interaction between society and economics. I probably need to make a couple of quick disclaimers. I have no training at all in economics. This will be obvious, so perhaps it's redundant to say so. My studies in this at college were long, long ago and quite rudimentary. What do I mean, incidentally, by economics? I just simply mean the science of generating and distributing wealth, allocating resources effectively. I want to take refuge in Bernard Shaw's comment that, quote, if all economists were laid end to end, they still would not reach a conclusion. So we have some leeway here in expressing opinion. Second disclaimer, this is not a session about the scriptures and economics. Not about the scriptures. I'm going to ignore Israel's economy. That will come later. All that I want to do is to sketch in a backdrop to try to illuminate and frame what we will do during the rest of the weekend. I'll also stop in the 19th century because I'm concerned with roots rather than recent developments, and because the economics of the 20th century would take several sessions all to themselves. But be encouraged, this evening Al will take us into the future. So we get the past, we get the future, we probably won't get the present. Are any of you trained as economists? Praise God. Whoops, one. Oh dear. Well, you need to block your ears and you need to pray. We will take great liberties with the truth. Okay, I want to start with a quotation from one of my role models, Winston Churchill. The inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. The inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of miseries. I like this because Churchill was not an economist either, and that appeals to me. What is one good recent example of an economic theory that, if you like, created an entire social and political system. Karl Marx, Marxism, exactly. There are many examples of social movements largely driven by economic factors or theories. I'll just mention four more, because Marxism is the most obvious one. Surprisingly, the Crusades in medieval Europe, in my opinion, were largely economic. Population growth, scarcity of land, attraction of novelties in the East, etc. Secondly, the trade union movement is a movement founded upon economic need. Thirdly, the British Empire is largely economic in its origin. And fourthly, the colonization of the American West. Let me say a word about the empire and about the American West. Adam Smith, the founder of modern economics, wrote, quote, "To found a great empire for the sole purpose of raising up a people of commerce may appear a project fit for a nation of shopkeepers." He thought of the British as a nation of shopkeepers, and he saw very insightfully that the reason for the fact that we kept colonizing more and more countries was for trade, for economic reasons. What about where we are now, the American West? Someone once said that the American West is an idea that became a place. It captures the restless entrepreneurial spirit, the essence of the American character, always pushing back the frontiers, always harnessing nature for our betterment. The seven verbs of our job description from God, which I mentioned just now, are a colonist's charter. In the 19th century, in the American West, despite some atrocities that you're aware of, was a period of high obedience to our biblical mandate. Starting with the Spanish quest for gold, continuing with beavers, fur hats, going on to wheat and cattle and gold and silver and lumber and oil, the economic factors both created and shaped this western part of our country. Well, if all this is so, and if we are so visibly connected to Genesis 1 and 2, why is it that, regrettably, for most of the last two millennia, the institutional church has positioned itself as the ultimate authority on economics and has been negative to economics in its influence? I give you a quotation on this from the historian Tawney, quote, "Economic interests were subordinated to the real business of life, which is salvation," unquote. The church really didn't understand the fullness of the gospel. And yet the church kept a repressive grip on economic development. Charging interest, for example, was considered a mortal sin by many medieval theologians. That's why so many great banking families, such as the Rothschilds, are Jews. The church also blocked free markets because it kept on debating the idea of a just price. It hated the idea of bargains. Let me give you one other, more interesting example of the stultifying effect of church dogma on trade and commerce. I think Jim referred to it, the magnetic compass. In Columbus's day, using a floating needle and a compass to find north seemed like black magic. So the prudent captain would hide his compass in a binnacle or a little box, lest he be accused of trafficking with Satan. And he was, often. Some pious captains tried to get around the church's displeasure with the magnetic compass by saying, look, this compass that points north is supported at right angles by a straw as it floats in the binnacle. Ah, that's a holy cross. It's okay. Isn't that puerile? The church's attitude to such innovations was often at best ambivalent, though people were forced to resort to such tactics. Now, why would this be the attitude of the religious authorities? What do you think? Excuse me?
Loss of control.
Good. Fear. fear of the unknown, fear of something you couldn't find in the Bible. Seemed to contradict biblical stories. Yeah, the earth is firmly fixed, it shall not be moved. I think Jim quoted that. I would say that the main reasons are that the church as an institution cherished stability. It's keep everything hierarchical, clean, and organized. And as Al told us this morning, in the Middle Ages and indeed throughout history, there are these three international power systems: religions, politics or government, and commercial. Now, lest I beat up on the church too much, let me speak well of modern Roman Catholic social teaching. There's a tremendous amount of excellent teaching coming out of the Vatican in the last 50 to 70 years on social matters, on trade unions, on wages, on population theory, and so on. I was working with a group on developing a theology of work, Module 5, last year, and found a great deal of help from the Catholic pronouncements. But nevertheless, in general, the religious and the political triangles tend to be suspicious of the commercial triangle. And yet I want to suggest to you that it is the commercial arena which offers the best channel today for the gospel. Not governments, not religions, commerce. Usually, as I say, the three triangles are in tension, but not always. Here's something that David Livingstone, the explorer in Africa, told some students at Cambridge in 1860. "My object," he said, "is to open up traffic along the banks of the Zambezi River and also, please note, also to preach the gospel. The natives of Central Africa are very desirous of trading. It is therefore desirable to open a way for the consumption of free production and the introduction of Christianity and commerce. These two pioneers of civilization, Christianity and commerce, should ever be inseparable. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity." Well, he's gone over the top there, hasn't he? Here is the reverse of what I was talking about, an alliance of religion and commerce to the distraction and detriment of religion, because it is essentially built on his political conviction, namely that we owe to the nations the blessings of our Western civilization. Civilization in that case, of course, meant the British way of doing things, which is neither permanent nor biblical. Sometimes I think that the British invented ethnocentrism. I was taught at school a little ditty which illustrates this about culture. It says, "The Turks, they live in Turkey, the Romans live in Rome, the Germans live in Germany, but the British live at home." So we are the center of the universe. It's very clarifying to think like that. In any case, whatever the situation, wealth and poverty, trade and greed are a frequent engine of political progress, especially in free democracies, where the acquisitive nature that God has given us has the space to operate. De Tocqueville, talking about what he saw here in the USA and generalizing, said, "In democracies, nothing is more brilliant than commerce. It attracts the attention of the public. It fills the imagination of the multitude. All energetic passions are directed towards commerce." Okay? I'm going now to section 3. I'm going right back to the beginning after an introduction and some comments on Christianity and commerce. Section 3, Agriculture, the Beginnings. Neolithic man, as you know, passed from hunting and gathering into agriculture. Nobody seems to be quite sure when, but we know it happened. And the important thing for us as believers is that this first transition from hunting to agriculture changed the whole human value system. I cannot express it better than Will and Ariel Durant in their book on the lessons of history. They write, "Because of this change, industriousness became more vital than bravery, regularity and thrift became more profitable than violence, peace better than war, children were economic assets, for the first time. Birth control was made immoral because we were now on farms. And on farms, the family is the unit of production under the discipline of the father and the seasons. And for 1,500 years or more, this agricultural mode of thinking maintained itself in Christian Europe and throughout the cultures that derive from Christian Europe. That's what happened as a result of the agricultural revolution. And economic innovation always reframes cultural thinking and values. We just have to make sure that it reframes them in biblical directions. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we get socialism. Socialism, by the way, was not invented by Karl Marx. There is a city called Sumer at the head of the Persian Gulf, or there was, 2100 BC. And in this city of Sumer, the economy was organized by the state. It was a perfect socialist state. Arable land was owned by the crown. Laborers received rations from the crops delivered to the royal storehouses. Foreign trade was carried out in the name of the central administration. So here is a city which already was well into socialism 2,000 years before Jesus came. The longest sustained socialist experiment that historians are aware of took place in Peru. The Incas, for four centuries, maintained a very centralized state in which everybody reported to the emperor, and this was a highly bureaucratic system. It was not wiped out until 1533 when Pizarro conquered the Incas. So there's been a lot of socialism before Marx. Let's go on and talk briefly about trading and coinage. In the ancient world, the Phoenicians were the expert traders. They came before the Greeks. They operated out of Tyre and Sidon, and you're familiar with them as descriptions of market economies in the scriptures. The Phoenicians traveled from the eastern Mediterranean by sea. In fact, they reached as far as England in search of tin, 600, 700, 800 BC. They traded in ivory, wood, linen, purple cloth, wine, salt. They invented glass. Of special interest is the fact that the alphabet that they invented is the ancestor of modern alphabets, such as the Roman one that we use. So the Phoenicians were very entrepreneurial people and represent, to my mind, the best example in the period before 600 BC of a trading commercial nation that made a success of commerce and entrepreneurship. The next economic breakthrough was the invention of coinage. The first coins were minted in a city called Sardis, S-A-R-D-I-S, in Lydia, which is modern Turkey, around 650 BC. Why were they needed? Because there was a trade going on through what is now Turkey. Ivory would come up from Africa, grain would be taken back down to Africa. A little thought shows us that it takes an enormous pile of grain to pay for a couple of elephant tusks. So there's an imbalance in the trade. What to do? Fortunately, the river that flowed through Sardis had as a natural deposit electrum, which is an amalgam of silver and gold, a natural alloy. So somebody had the bright idea to get this electrum, put it into nuggets, and stamp them and make them a standard weight, the first coins in the world. Sardis, 650 BC. So the caravans would leave to go back to Africa carrying some grain and some pottery and also a bag of electrum nuggets, carefully registered as being authentic, real money. This idea spread rapidly, very quickly. Trade boomed. The kings of Sardis got so excited about this, over the next 50 years, they invented another thing which is still with us. That is the shopping mall. 620 BC, they developed in Sardis a retail marketplace lined with small shops from which descended the Greek agora, or marketplace, and the modern American shopping mall, and the medieval market, for that matter. Athens got hold of this. Athens was fascinated by this, and the Athenians basically took over. They defeated the Persian Empire, which included Sardis, and within a few generations, it was the coins of Athens with the owl of Minerva on them that formed the trading currency throughout the eastern Mediterranean. The sad thing is it took about 20,000 slaves in the silver mines north of Athens, south of Athens to produce the coinage that lubricated the commerce of the day. The historian Herodotus, talking about the people of Sardis, called them, like the British, a nation of shopkeepers, because he said they had changed mere trade into true commerce. Very important in our survey of history. And one of the reasons it's important is that this economic breakthrough, coinage, again, changed social patterns. For example, women accumulated enough power to decide which husbands they wanted to marry, because they now had currency. Before, they were just chattels. In Sardis, there emerged brothels, and there emerged gambling, both the trades which are dependent on coinage. You've heard the phrase, as rich as Croesus. Croesus was the last in the line of the kings of Sardis until they were conquered in 546 BC by the Persian Cyrus, who's mentioned in the scriptures. So here we have, for the last 26 centuries, coins, usually metal, but not universally metal. Do you know how the Roman army were often paid? In salt, from which we get our English word salary. Salary literally means salt. Another example, in East Africa, in some of the nomadic peoples, cattle are still used as a form of currency. We have an English word, pecuniary. Some pecuniary advantage I receive if you give me some dollars. Pecuniary means wealthy in cattle. So we have salt and we have cattle. They both found their way into the language that we use today in commerce. Other things, too. I was in Romania before the fall of the dictator Ceausescu, and one of the currencies, as Milan would confirm, was cigarettes, usually Kent cigarettes, because the coinage that he kept printing was of no value. However, in general, in summary, we humans seem to value gold. Gold doesn't tarnish like silver, doesn't rust like iron, doesn't turn green like copper. It's clean and it's pure. Let's go on to section 5, which I've called Kinship, Command, and Market, rather mysteriously. I want to suggest to you that there are basically only three economic systems that everything else is a derivative of. The first is the system that has to do with kinship. The system of an agricultural society. It's related to the family. People contribute produce to whatever is the hierarchy in that society. The patriarch of the family is in charge. Very changeless, very local, very stable. Bedouin and Eskimo, in some cases, still cling to this way of life. And this has been extremely common in our history. The second type of economy is the command economy, such as Marxism, socialism, central planning. People pay tribute, or in modern command economies, taxes. It's autocratic. It's very good at mobilizing us for large-scale works. The temples of the Incas, the Great Wall of China, the pyramids of Egypt, all come out of command economies, where the center decides what we do next. Moderately frequent. Lastly, of course, the market. Markets allow specialization, as Adam Smith realized. They're entrepreneurial. People pay tax rather than tribute or giving their cauliflowers in. They pay financial tax, democratic, energetic. Most modern Western societies operate this way. It is very rare in the history of humanity. We think it's what all the right people do all the time. Maybe it is today, but it has not been so. So you have kinship, command, and market systems. With that in mind as background, I want to talk a little bit more about the Greeks and the origins of the market. The Persians, as I indicated, in the Persian Empire, which contained Sardis, what is now Turkey, ran a command system. The Greeks, on the other hand, ran a market system because they borrowed the idea of coinage from Lydia. Who do you think prevailed? Those who had the market, those who enjoyed freedom. The Greeks beat up on the Persians, Marathon, Salamis, and by 472 BC, the Greeks were in command of the eastern Mediterranean. Almost always, a market economy will outrun a command economy. Most modern economies, as you know, are somewhat of a mixture of command and market, with the emphasis increasingly being on market, for which we thank God. But the Greeks invented a new kind of civilization. I'm not going to talk about their philosophy, which you might think of when I say Greeks, but they invented a civilization which was based on commerce and centered in the marketplace, the agora, the meeting place, the exchange of things place. Because they had money, they were able to broaden the number of leaders, not just hereditary families, and because they had money, people learned to count, and counting, you may not realize this, stimulates abstract thought. If I have to go beyond my fingers, I've got to think at a higher level, and this stimulates a capacity to think conceptually. Also, slaves could be bought and sold with the money they now had. You didn't have to go to war to get more slaves. There was thus space for leisure, for reflection, and for philosophy. The Greek historian Xenophon wrote the first book ever entitled Economics, the predecessor of Samuelson's book, which so many of us work through. Economics to the Greeks meant skill in managing one's household or one's estate. Very practical. However, the intellectual tradition of the Greeks, which we're aware of, was very nervous about this because it frowned upon manual work and it frowned upon the money that it generated. Plato remarked, money stimulates the passions. Bad thing. Greeks liked rationality. Plato, indeed, went so far as to want to outlaw money. It had been around for about 150 years when he tried to do that or tried to argue for it. He felt that no honest person could ever be wealthy because dishonesty must always pay better than honesty. Logically, I suppose that might sound good, but that's what he thought. Aristotle did a little bit better. He distinguished as two uses of money, which we still talk about today. He said, money is a medium of exchange. I can buy and sell bottles of things. That's good, he said. And he said, money is also a store of value. That's bad, he felt, because you shouldn't accumulate value and get rich. It's not good for the community. He was the first to think seriously about economics, but he led us right down a blind alley, which lasted for more than 1,000 years, which is why I'm concentrating on it now. It's very important that we understand the influence of the Greeks right through the medieval period, up to the Enlightenment. Aristotle chose to make the wrong contrast. He made a contrast between using money and gaining from money. And here there are two Greek words he used, and I'll show you the contrast and some of its characteristics. He talked about oikonomia, which means managing one's household, and as I said, that's a good thing. We get our word economy from that. But he also talked about chremististike, which is a word that we don't have in English, mercifully, and that means making money, making profit, bad, he said. And you see, one is natural and one is unnatural. Now, there's an interesting distinction here and an important one. The small-scale economic family units of the time were based on status. And that was the way that the Greeks felt it should be. But this profiteering was based on making contracts. And that sort of negotiating, that sort of commercial thing, smelt. Somebody was going to lose every time you had a contract. There's the comparison which went right on into the era of about 1300 or 1400 of a just price, which is good, and bargains. Aristotle spent a lot of time talking about what is the just price for something like a packet of oranges. There must be one clear, philosophically accurate price. Blind alley. Oikonomia is good for the community. Chromisticity is good for the individual. That was Aristotle's flawed analysis. If he had not used use and gain, but had talked like we do about production and distribution, he would have, I think, made all the difference. Aristotle had no economics of scarcity. Why? Because he felt there was no scarcity. What do you do in an economy like ancient Greece when things are scarce? Get more slaves. Get more stuff produced. So scarcity was not a big deal. Just ramp up the slavery. Now, one more quotation on this from Weatherford's new book published this year on the history of money. What was different for the Greeks, what made them sort of leap ahead in the practice of their economics, although not the theology of it, was that they lived next door to the Lydians from Sardis who invented money. The Greeks were a largely unformed civilization, but their adoption of money propelled them forward past all the other peoples of the Mediterranean. Greece was the first civilization to be transformed by money. We shouldn't be too harsh on Plato and Aristotle. After all, money was only invented a couple of centuries before, and we know how much resistance there is today to new technology, to new ways of doing things. Section 7, the Romans and trade. Taking a great leap here, several hundred years, we're leaping basically from the 5th century BC to the period of the Roman era that I want to talk about is the 1st century BC to the 3rd century AD. The Roman era, the High Roman era. Let me tell you again about a word. I told you about salary and salt. So many of these words that we use today have fascinating histories. Go back to 269 BC, dark and stormy night in Rome. Somewhere in the north of Italy are some invading people from what is now France, some Gauls. The Romans knew that they were coming, but they didn't know when they were coming or how many of them there were. They knew that a battle was looming. The Romans that night were warned by the honking of geese around the temple of Juno in the center of Rome. They didn't normally honk, but they just let off such a clamor, everybody woke up, everybody got on the alert, and yes, their Gauls were just outside the city, ready to attack. This temple of Juno became known, therefore, as Juno Monita, in Latin, Juno the Warner. She who warns us. Thanks, Juno, for the geese. It helped. We repelled the Gauls. That very year, the Romans found it necessary to introduce a new coin, the denarius. And they manufactured it in the temple of Juno. And they put on it her name, Monita, M-O-N-E-T-A, she who warns. That's where we get our word money from. Monita, from the honking of the geese. You may or may not like such digressions, but I enjoy them. Okay. The Romans were not innovators. They were slow, plodding people. They ate a lot of porridge with their salt. They clomped around. But they did believe in trade, and they built up the conditions for trade throughout their empire. Their peace, in Latin, the Pax Romana, was built on 5 ingredients. Now we're talking about the period when the Roman Empire is at its maximum. It stretches all the way from what is now Iran to what is now Gibraltar. It stretches up to England and northern Germany and well down into the Sahara. What were the conditions that gave that empire such freedom to trade? What would you think? The road system. Good, that they constructed. Anything else? Communications. Yep. Particularly the postal system, Jerry, as you know. Someone else said something.
Well, they were able to create political
stability. Stability, which you could call peace. Yeah. They just maintained peace. Okay, we got roads, we got communications, we got peace. laws. Good. They had a legal framework that provided for the new idea of contract. If any of you are real estate developers, you know that without a law of contract, life is a bit flaky. So basically, I see five things in the Roman peace, which lasted from just before the time of Christ to 300 or 400 AD. In the Pax Romana, the Roman peace. And one is the fact of peace itself. Now, let me just say something about this, because we could say, well, that's kind of obvious, but it wasn't obvious in those stages. The poet of Imperial Rome, Virgil, who wrote poetry at the time of Jesus, had a line in one of his poems that the job description of Rome was pacere subjectis et debellare superbos, to spare the conquered and war down the proud. Novel idea, spare the conquered. Why not crucify them? Why not castrate them? Why not burn them in oil? 1,000 years later, people did things like that. The Romans said, no, we want to spare the conquered. Why? Every conquered people is a new market. Every conquered people is someone else to Romanize. Every conquered people adds to the wealth of the empire. Don't kill them. Just make sure they obey you. So they would spare the conquered, but wore down those who resisted. Superb roads, as somebody has mentioned. Why is the rail gauge in America 4'8.5"? Answer, that was the width between the ruts of the average main highway among the Roman roads and represents the space within which two horses or mules could pull a carriage. I don't have time to trace the history of that, but through various stages, that odd thing of 4'8.5" came from the Roman roads. Their postal system was never bettered until at least the end of the 18th century. They had teams of horses every 100 miles or whatever throughout the empire to carry the imperial mail. Their common language, Latin, a trade language. A trade language is necessary for trade. Swahili is a modern example, so is English. Helps us trade. And the legal framework, particularly the code of the Emperor Justinian. Now, I want to suggest to you, as I put on the slide, that these five advantages of the Roman peace are, if you like, somewhat of an extended commentary on Paul's phrase in the book of Galatians, that Jesus came in the fullness of time. He came when the conditions were ripe to disseminate the gospel. And Al talked about this and showed us maps about it last night. So I'm just amplifying what he was saying. This fifth condition, a legal framework, is profoundly important. Because unless you have a law of contract, people will step out of line and will make a fast buck. They also invented the idea of a corporation, which is still with us today. They believed in making money. They believed in conspicuous consumption. They spent incredible sums to flaunt their position. They spent incredible sums to get elected. They had not heard of campaign finance reform. That was not one of their things. They were great traders. And they bought perfume from Arabia, silk from India, spices also. Many of the best Roman recipes that were particularly succulent required pepper. And they would send out whole fleets of ships to gain pepper. Persius was a Roman poet who wrote in the days of St. Paul, in English translation, four lines of Persius, "The greedy merchants led by lucre run to the parched Indies and the rising sun. From thence hot pepper and rich drugs they bear, bartering for spices their Italian ware." Trade. Roman coins are found in China and all over Asia. So that's the Romans, traders par excellence, with stability, those five conditions. Next, the monasteries. A jump to anywhere from the 6th century to the 12th century AD. You see, the early church fathers, in the first 200 years of Christianity, had treated economic topics with indifference. Despite the fact that Jesus talked more about money than anything else, it was not a hot theological topic. Much more important were things like whether the Son was co-equal with the Father or subordinate to the Father and things like that. Economics was a turnoff. The Church Fathers focused on the right use of what we have, not on the dynamics of a market and how to acquire more. But one bright ray here is the monasteries, because the monasteries were the economic and social units that helped carry Europe through the Dark Ages. You see, monasteries were a microcosm of medieval society. They not only preserved learning, but they served as economic centers. Monks did work. They planted things. They made things, chairs, tables, etc. And so these monasteries mark, if you like, the transition from extended families to small towns, which we have springing up throughout Europe in the later Middle Ages, particularly in the north. Monks invented alarm clocks. Why? Because they needed to know when to pray five times a day. Monks explored and made maps. I wish I had time to tell you about St. Brendan and how he sailed west from Ireland and made a map showing that he'd found paradise. And as late as 1759, there were maps published in Europe which showed paradise somewhere to the west of Ireland, because St. Brendan said it was there. Must be. Monks demonstrated the value of hard work. Monasteries were good. We're now in section 9, the medieval interlude. Medieval is vast, vast ages again. Long Middle Ages. Economic thought progressed only slowly, because it was really a fusion of the Greek thinking, Aristotle and Plato, which was essentially negative, and church traditions, which were somewhat repressive. So you can understand, it wouldn't go anywhere fast. Feudalism was the economic system. The king was the ultimate owner of the land, and he distributed land to nobles, particularly after a notable victory, and they let the peasants work on the land. So when a peasant said, "I own something," he really didn't. He only owned the right to work the land. So this is a regression from Roman law. The context was local. People belonged to one of three very simple classes: peasants, who worked, military, who fought, and clergymen, who contemplated. It was as simple as that. And the more the clergymen contemplated, the more they took to themselves what they thought was good economic thinking. They became the repository of economic thinking. They didn't do too well. Let me show you four major medieval Christian philosophers. Typically, they're called scholastics. And they're answering the question, what is the source of value? Why is a banana more valuable than a cauliflower? Well, Albertus thought it was the cost of production. That's the only thing that determines value. Thomas Aquinas thought it was human wants. The more I want something, the more valuable it is. Henry of Fremont said scarcity. Fremont said scarcity. And Buridan said desire backed by money. So they were really all over the shop. They never came up with a way of integrating in economics the theory of needs and the theory of costs. They would perch at costs or they would perch at needs. They couldn't get it together. We talked about the origin of coinage. What about the origin of paper money, bills? Printing, as I think Jim mentioned, and paper making and paper money all began in China. Around the time of Christ, the first paper in China was made from the bark of the mulberry tree, whose leaves fed the caterpillars that made silk. So that was a very integrated production system. But for 1,000 years or so, it remained bottled up in China. And then a few European rulers, under pressure, under siege, began to use, instead of coins, which they ran out of, scraps of paper or bits of leather. And that was the origin of our paper money. The first real, organized, clear paper money was introduced in 1690 in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And the first person to write a treatise on paper money was Benjamin Franklin. That's why the $100 bill still carries Franklin's image, not one of the other presidents. The top denomination honors the person who wrote in 1729 an essay on paper currency. Kenneth Galbraith, liberal economist, but in many ways a very articulate one, observes that, quote, if the history of commercial banking belongs to the Italians, and if the history of central banking belongs to the British, paper money issued by a government has a history that belongs indubitably to the Americans. Back to medieval society. Why did it work if it was so stagnant? It worked because the peasants needed the security of the manor. They worked for the lord of the manor in an enclosed, protected system. Life was nasty, brutish, and short. A study done on the sons of English dukes in the 14th century showed that their life expectancy was only 24 years. Remember, the British had a 100 years war with the French? Most people got killed most of the time, and when they didn't, they caught the plague. So people needed security. Manors, therefore, were self-sufficient. Manors, M-A-N-O-R-S, little need for money. And the only place where money was really used were at the annual fairs in the growing cities. And these fairs were beautiful things. They're the ancestors of our flea markets. So that was a nice innovation. Another innovation in the medieval period in urban life was guilds. Now, you might think that a guild is, you know, for all the carpenters to get together and make more money. That was not the idea at all. Although guilds were the basic economic unit of the Middle Ages, their purpose was not to make money. Their purpose was, guess what? To preserve an ordered way of life among the professionals and to minimize, you might say that that's the purpose of the AMA or a number of other organizations which exist to protect professional standards. These medieval guilds survive, at least in name. In London, for example, we still have the Worshipful Company of Candlemakers. And that's nice. They meet in their regalia. But I want you to feel the stability of medieval society in order to experience the rush of energy and of blood to the head that occurred later. This is from Barbara Tuckman's marvelous book, A Distant Mirror. Quote, to ensure that no one gained an advantage over anyone else, commercial law in the 14th century prohibited innovation in tools or techniques, prohibited underselling below a fixed price, prohibited working late by artificial light. That would make most of us illegal. Employing extra apprentices or one's wife, and there was to be no advertising or praising them to the detriment of other people's products. That's a recipe for stagnation, isn't it? Medieval thought was permeated with religion, and religion was uneasy with economic innovation. The general view was that a merchant can scarcely ever be pleasing to God. I read an amusing story recently about a certain monk. His name was Humbertus, and he tells about a person. This is supposed to be a joke. He tells about a person who found a devil in every nook and every cranny of a palace in Florence, Italy. And then he went to the marketplace, and he only found one devil. The reason, Humbertus tells us, was that it took only one devil to corrupt a marketplace because every businessman harbored a devil in his heart already. Ha, 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 you see? Religion wins, and commerce loses. Now, in that sort of environment, things don't go well. It is wholly sinful, wrote Thomas Aquinas, to practice fraud with the express purpose of selling a thing for more than its just price. Basically, bargains were immoral. And you know what? What did they miss that we love? Now, we've gone ballistic over this. I mean, we love this, but they didn't have it at all. The idea of an expanding economy, a growing scale of production, increasing productivity, was as foreign to the guildmaster or fair merchant as to the serf and lord. Medieval economic organization was a means of reproducing but not enhancing the material well-being of the past. The idea was to perpetuate, not to make progress. Progress is a very modern idea, very strange idea to most cultures. Okay, I'm on section 10, breaking the mold. Given this dead inertia, why would anything ever break loose? What are some reasons, do you think? Let me answer the question because we're running out of time. There are lots of reasons, and you were about to say many of them, so that's reassuring. here are some of the main reasons. Merchants. What, as we say nowadays, travel broadens the mind. These are things that broke up the mold of medieval stagnancy. Trade came again from Arabia and India, like in the Roman days. New ways, new thoughts, new possibilities. Urbanization. New towns. New towns found they couldn't feed their expanding population, so they had to trade. The Crusades. I mentioned that. The Crusaders were astonished to find in places like Antioch and Jerusalem and Tyre much more vibrant and civilized and knowledgeable people than they were themselves. Their imaginations were fertilized by what they discovered. Aggregation. What I mean is that these little manors began to combine because economies of scale were sort of dimly percolating. It is said that there were more than 60 toll stations along the River Rhine. Imagine doing business with 60 visas, 60 payments, 60 customs duties. This began to disappear as units clumped into bigger units. Exploration. Marco Polo made a start, and then each king in medieval Europe used to send out expeditions. Why? Because they believed that what was needed to strengthen their country was gold. This produced price inflation, very severe price inflation. Colonies. The colonies in America and in India gave strong impetus to commercial trade because we had to supply the pioneers. Exotic foods, objects like tobacco and chocolate became popular, tea. Seventh, Calvinism. In contrast to the Roman Catholics with their stability, these new Protestants approved of hard work as an index of spiritual maturity. They argued that our worldly calling, our vocation, had merit. They argued for thrift and for investment. Wealth should be emphasized. It meant that God has blessed me. Reversal. Excellent legacy of the Reformation. And lastly, technology. Jim talked about this to some degree. Double entry bookkeeping was invented in 1494. Printing, water mills, many types of technology. Insurance, all the things needed for commerce. And the Protestant countries of the north in Europe raced ahead of the Catholic countries in the south. We see the emergence of labor as a commodity that can be sold and bought. We see people becoming more mobile. We see cities stimulating knowledge, urbanization. Lloyd's of London, the big insurance market, started in a coffee house. Where do a lot of us make little deals today? Starbucks. Coffee houses. Same thing. Property becomes capital, able to earn interest or profits. Now, at last, we're back on biblical ground, because in the parable of the talents, for example, the word interest, the Greek word tokos, T-O-K-O-S, literally means offspring, baby, birth. It's not inertia. Interest is a living thing, a force, a fruitful energy. That's what the Greek word meant. It had got lost somewhere in transmission. So we're becoming more true to the parable of the talents, I think. 11, countries as communities. Just a little comment here. Countries were taking shape in the 16th century, 17th century. Nationalism is rooted in modernity. Nationalism began to arise during the Enlightenment. People thought less in terms of status and more in terms of their traditional, of their cultural similarity. Local languages, very important, replaced Latin. Exploration painted the colors of the world map. And people even became romantic about their ethnicity. The British wrote poems about King Arthur, the French lauded Joan of Arc, and the Germans celebrated the Teutonic bloodline. Not always with good consequences in any of those cases, but nationalism led to a romantic view of ethnicity. Here's a summary quotation from Gellner's new book on nationalism. Very fine, short book. Traditional society taught that man was made by his status. The Enlightenment taught that man was made by his reason. And the Romantic movement, 18th century, early 19th century, taught that he was made by his roots. I'm English. I've got roots in that place. And that was very important and also very dangerous. could say more about the interaction of nationalism and economics, but I won't, because I want to talk about mercantilism. Mercantilism is not a word we often use, but basically, it was the first modern school of economists, 16th to 18th century. They were called the mercantilists. They argued that for things to go well, one, a country should maintain order by granting monopolies, like the Hudson Bay Company or the East India Company. Two, a country should acquire colonies, the more the merrier, to extract raw materials. And three, a country should restrict foreign trade, being sure always to export more than it imported, because you want to export goods and bring in gold, and gold equals value. That was the theory. In other words, they believed that economics was a zero-sum game. I gain, you lose. And all the real wealth was silver and gold. You know, often Spain brought back the gold and England stole it. In 1702, for example, the annual Spanish treasure fleet was coming from Cuba, 38 ships loaded with silver, went into the Spanish port of Vigo, home base, to unload. The British came along, burnt the lot, and not only did they do that, which I think was rather uncharitable, you know, we didn't bother to go over and get some ourselves, we just helped ourselves to some of the Spanish gold, but then Queen Anne added insult to injury by having made on the coins that she made from this silver that we'd collected in Vigo, below her own bust, the word Vigo, just so that whenever a Spaniard saw it, he would remember the insult. This is one of the fruits of the mercantile movement, the passionate belief that I must get gold. Gold equals value. I must give you one more example. General Wolfe captured Quebec for England in 1760, suppressed the French there. Not permanently, as we know. And the British Parliament debated the terms to be imposed on the French. And people in the Parliament in Britain, many of them, argued that the tiny sugar-rich islands of Guadeloupe would be much more important for Britain to hold on to than all of Canada. Because sugar is a commodity, it's tangible, whereas Canada represents unexplored potential. Fortunately, Benjamin Franklin was in London at the time, and he published an article in the British press arguing that Canada would be much more valuable for the British. And so we decided to kind of hold on to it, even though it didn't have any sugar. But it was by this sort of thinking, I suggest to you, that one of the reasons why the British lost the 13 American colonies. Because we were just busy extracting stuff from them. We needed stuff. Look at the map of West Africa next time you have an atlas. There are some countries in West Africa that come down to the sea like fingers. Strange little narrow countries, pencils, into the sea. Why would that be? The Europeans did that because they set up these countries artificially along the banks of a large river to extract all the slaves and all the gold that they could as efficiently as possible. So you have a country like Togo, just like that. Get the stuff to the sea. Rape the natives. The modern map of Africa discloses European greed. Adam Smith. After all of this mistaken thinking, Adam Smith is a tonic. Such confusion was a perfect target for him. He is the founder of modern economics, as you know. He argued wisely that wealth should be measured by our standard of living, not by the amount of gold in the central bank. He argued that wealth should be measured by the welfare of consumers, not the profits of monopolies. He argued that monopolies paralyze an economy and restrict innovation. And he talked about what he called perfect liberty, the market mechanism. Productivity, he observed, beautiful insight, arose from the division of labor, from specialization. He talks in a famous illustration about a pin factory. He says, a modern pin factory of the day, one man draws out the wire, another straightens it, a third one cuts it, a fourth one puts a point on it, and a fifth one puts the top on the pin. And they could make 48,000 pins a day with 10 people. But if they worked independently, they would make about 20 pins each. Beautiful illustration of specialization in the division of labor. He was also a realist. He had a nice quotation. He said, people of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or a contrivance to raise prices. So he was realistic about our greed. He was the apostle of capitalism, though he didn't use the term, and he saw clearly that we need to divide economics and politics to think clearly about either. Then we have the Industrial Revolution. Workers are now becoming dehumanized. Jim talked about this, the drive for efficiency. Tools were okay, machines are not. When with a tool, a man is in charge. With a machine, the machine is in charge. Industrial work became monotonous for the sake of efficiency. Listen to the American Frederick Taylor, the founder of scientific management, writing about 1880. Quote, "In the past, man has been first. In the future, the system will be first." And he liked that. That is a good thing, he said, because everyone will get richer. What are the best ways to get rich today? You know, you're businessmen. But what a contrast with just back 5 centuries to the 15th century. Alberti, a gentleman of Florence, asked that question in the 15th century. What is the best way to get rich? Well, back in the medieval period, he said, 1, become a wholesaler. 2, search for treasure. 3, befriend a rich man. 4, charge a high rate of interest. And 5, rent out horses. 5 ways to get rich. You know, the last business being the business of Hertz and Avis, renting out horses, right? So, very different mindset now comes with the Industrial Revolution. You want to make things and sell them, not be a wholesaler. See, the very word manufacture, which we think of with factories, it means making by hand. Manufacture, made by hand. So the old vocabulary persists. Anyway, the Industrial Revolution. Machines multiplied. Marriage was delayed. Women were emancipated. Contraceptives allowed us to separate intercourse from pregnancy. The authority of father and mother lost its economic base. There was a growing individualism. Jim talked about this. Youth became rebellious. They were no longer constrained by the elders in the village. They were anonymous. You can do anything you like in a motel room. Very anonymous. These are some of the downsides of the Industrial Revolution. If we compare the merchants that I told you about of Tyre and Sidon, 7 centuries before Christ, with the trading people of the Industrial Revolution, there is an enormous difference, although they're both trading. Let me give you 2 short stanzas from Masefield's poem, Cargoes, a poem about commerce. Listen to this one first. This is Tyre and Sidon. Imagine way back. Quinquereme of Nineveh from distant Ophir, rowing home to haven in sunny Palestine, with a cargo of ivory and apes and peacocks, sandalwood and cedarwood and sweet white wine. Now listen to this, 19th century, North Sea near Britain. Dirty British coaster with a salt cake smokestack butting up the channel in the mad March days with a cargo of tyne coal, road rail, pig lead, fireweed, ironware, and cheap tin trace. You hear the difference? There is a tremendous difference. The rhythm of life has accelerated. From the languid to the staccato, from oars to diesel engines. But it's still trade. It's still commerce. It's still biblical. 2 dominant isms, section 15. You can see why I chose to duck the 20th century. I just want to say a couple of things about capitalism and socialism. I want to say that capitalism emerged in stages and created a new breed of entrepreneur. Capitalism generated many changes, a sharp rise in production, factory work, a delayed rise in living standards, the separation of the home and the workplace that we've talked about, social dislocation, a flurry of technology, the growth of the working class and trade unions, and a vast accumulation of capital. Karl Marx looked at this in Britain, and he became indignant. The squalor and the slums and the abuse of the children that were very real. Life expectancy at birth in Manchester in 1820 for a baby was 17 years. It was a hard life. Child mortality rate more than 50%. Marx saw the anarchy, and he detested it, and he wanted to change it. But all the time, change was accelerating. That is the moral, by the way, of the handout that I gave you at the beginning. If you just look at that, What I'm suggesting is that throughout economic history, it's like a game of tennis where every stroke I make, I put topspin on. What does topspin do? It makes the ball come faster off the court, doesn't it? So these 10 revolutions that you have in that handout cumulatively accelerate the speed of change. So if you look down the last 5, 15th century, 19th century, 20th century, 21st century, revolutions 7, 8, and 9 have to do respectively with the sea, the land, and the air. You might like to know that. The sea, the land, and the air. You might like to look at revolution 7, the geographical revolution, the sextant, which helps us find latitude, and the chronometer, which helps us find longitude. For more than a year now, the best-selling list of books in Britain has contained a slim volume with the simple title, Longitude. The fascinating story of how John Harrison discovered the marine chronometer. In 1714, the British Parliament offered what is now several million dollars for any device which would help explorers and seamen find longitude. The reason they did that is that a gentleman with the glorious name of General Sir Cloudesley Shovel had just taken Gibraltar from the Spanish, and he came back triumphant and smashed up his entire fleet in Cornwall on the way home because he got his longitude wrong. People just couldn't calculate longitude. And for 50 years, the man John Harrison worked on perfecting the marine chronometer. It's a lovely little book. It deserves to be on the bestseller list. Digression. I'm sorry, I shouldn't do that at this time. What have we learned? Let me just show you here that there are basically four stages. Can I go 5 minutes more, Al? Thank you. This is a summary chart. Summary of some of what I've said, anyway. In the shaping of society as regards economics, there are four stages. We talked about hunter-gatherer, agricultural, industrial, and now, I haven't talked about it, but Jim did, and Al will, the information age. What we've got under here is the answer to several questions. In each of these four stages of human society, question one, how is interaction organized? In tribes, families, hierarchies, and now in networks, distributed networks, right? That's how people talk to one another. Second question, what is the dominant context for human society in each of these four stages? Answer, tents, farms, factories, and offices. Who is the dominant person in each of these stages of culture? Chief, head of household, capitalist, knowledge worker. What is the symbol of status? Being old, owning land, aristocracy, material possessions, and now access to information. And what is the basic system? Kinship. You remember I said there were only three systems? Kinship, command, and market. So you have kinship as the system in stage one. You have command more than market in stage two. You have market more than command in the industrial stage. And now more and more around the world we have market. This comes from a man called Watts Wacker, who just wrote a book on the 500-year storm, although he called it something else, and Jim didn't take anything from it. But it's very similar in some ways. Quite instructive. Four stages of human development and arranged in terms of the three types of economic system. Rather than discuss some conclusions, I want to give you just four. And then I stop. Conclusion one, in thinking about the history of economics and how it shapes society, very simple. Commerce exemplifies relationships. And for biblical people like you and me, that's a very important reason for being in commerce. Commerce exemplifies relationships. Indeed, the very word, when it was first used in English, meant sexual intercourse. I will have commerce with thee tonight, says Shakespeare's character. So it exemplifies relationships. Secondly, man is an economic animal. Despite the church, despite tradition, despite the problems of society, despite war, he will maximize value, whatever the barriers. Man is an economic animal. Third conclusion, we've touched on before. Man has an economic mandate to be a co-creator and co-sustainer within God's material world. And that's where we're going to be the rest of today. Man has an economic mandate to be a co-creator and co-sustainer within God's material world. And finally, fourthly, commerce is surely a crucial channel for the diffusion of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Commerce is a crucial channel for the diffusion of the gospel. Isaiah 11:9, until the earth be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. As long as men go down to the sea in ships and pray to their God upon great waters, as long as there is commerce, the gospel will be carried around the world. And commercial people have the high privilege of carrying and modeling that gospel. Thank you.